When Bolin and Mokhtar reached the hovercraft, Bolin grabbed hold of a portside handhold, then pulled Mokhtar over and had him do the same. As he paused to catch his breath, Bolin strained his ears, trying to hear over the loud splashing made by the crocodile as it finished off its prey.
Up here!
Bolin glanced up and saw Kissinger leaning over the foredeck, extending a pole down toward the water. Grimaldi stood behind him, holding Kissinger by the waist so that he could lean farther out. Bolin pulled him further up out of the water via the handholds, then helped Mokhtar up to the pole. Bolin steadied him as Kissinger began to pull. Slowly, Mokhtar rose toward the deck. Dakotas appeared beside Kissinger and Grimaldi and reached over the side. He was able to grab hold of Mokhtar's wrist.
I've got you.
Mokhtar let go of the pole. Otis pulled him upward, and Grimaldi moved over to help the wounded man onto the deck. Mokhtar collapsed onto the deck, clutching his shoulder. Blood seeped through his fingers. Bolin then reached up for the pole. Kissinger set the pole aside and gave Bolin a hand, pulling him up to the deck.
Who do you think you are, Mark Spitz?
I was thinking more along the lines of Johnny Weissmuller.
Latek. Turns out he was worth taking along after all.
Bolin moved over to Mokhtar's side. Grimaldi was leaning over the younger man, inspecting his gunshot wound. He already had the bleeding in check.
How bad is it?
Looks nasty, but hopefully it missed any vitals.
It stings a little when I breathe.
Have you coughed up any blood?
No.
I'll track down a med kit.
Stay put, Rocky.
Bolin made his way to the side deck. Glancing ashore, he saw bodies strewed across the docks and around the jeep, but there was no sign of activity. Near the doorway to the passenger cabin, Rojas and Bond were crouched over Hager, trying to staunch the flow of blood from a gunshot wound to his neck. It wasn't working. Rojas pulled his reddened hands away.
He's gone. Where's Maruf?
He went to check things out on shore.
Desert Eagle in hand, Bolin climbed up to the docks and cautiously made his way toward the jeep, sidestepping the bodies of the fallen Lashkar gunners. In the back of the jeep, he noticed a footlocker strapped down securely inside a slightly larger box cushioned by a layer of foam pellets. Curious, Bolin unfastened the straps and raised the lid of the footlocker. Inside, beneath a layer of folded hazmat suits, were more than two dozen small slabs of C5 plastique stacked in neat rows, each stick separated from the others by a sheet of bubble wrap. There was also a smaller third container, the size of a cigar box, filled with a bound roll of wire, several detonators, and an equal number of digital LCD timers. Bolin was still pondering his discovery when Maruf stepped out of a small clapboard shack set near the road leading to the docks and strode over to the jeep.
We got them all.
At least for now. Any chance they could hear us back at the camp?
Not likely. Daimaton is still 5 miles away. They use explosives for tunneling through the quarry.
And for bombs.
Yes, for bombs, too.
Does that road lead to the camp?
Yes, it leads to the old access road where they have the plane.
Bolin circled to the front of the jeep. The driver had fallen away from the steering wheel, but was still sprawled across the front seat. Bolin dragged the body from the car, then got behind the wheel and stared out through the fractured windshield as he started the engine. It seemed to be running smoothly. Bolin turned off the ignition, then glanced back at the explosives.
What are you thinking?
Let's have another look at that diagram you drew for me earlier. I think there might be a better way to pull this off.
An hour later, the hovercraft emerged from the rainforest and rounded a bend that led to Daimatan's old quarry. Maruf was at the controls in the wheelhouse. Peering through the windshield, he saw a broad clearing off to his right and the Hercules C-130 resting in the middle of the old access road. The landing gear had apparently been repaired because men were unloading containers from two flatbed trucks parked near the cargo hatch and carrying them up a ramp into the plane's hold. It looked as if it would be a while before the plane took off. Beyond the plane, up atop a knoll dotted with acacia trees, Maruf saw a pair of helicopters, both Sultan EG-23s, like the one that had been abandoned back in the mountains. Unlike that chopper, however, these were combat-equipped gunships. Maruf had been concerned that both choppers might be in use. To find both of them where he'd last seen them was a good omen. He checked his watch. Their plan could still work. Guards soon appeared along the riverbanks. Maruf slowed the hovercraft.
Salam! Salam!
Where is your crew?
Dayak warriors attacked a boat a second time. We lost everyone. There's just three of the mercenaries and me.
There have been other attacks on Lascar troops in the area. It seems that the Dayak are getting bolder.
Porto has had enough. He's decided it is time to move camp.
To where?
East, to Etona. We will be leaving in the morning.
Maruf understood Porto's reasoning. Ertonan was located higher up in the mountains, 60 miles northeast of Daimatan. It was an area less congested by other tribes, and the mountains were as honeycombed with caves as the range where they'd originally stockpiled the stolen pesticides. It would be an easier locale to defend, and if need be, to flee from.
Porto is waiting for the mercenaries. He wants to finish things with Yafal before we leave.
I understand.
The guards stepped back and traded salutes with Maruf, who proceeded to guide the hovercraft another quarter mile. There he veered the craft from the river into a lagoon, leading to a dock not unlike the one at the checkpoint. The quarry lay just beyond view on the other side of a long plateau. The plateau was busy with activity. As many as three dozen Lashkar soldiers were stacking provisions they'd hauled up from the quarry. Nearby, a driver was carefully backing up a semi-trailer to the base of the plateau. Maruf cut back on the engines as he drew near the docks. A handful of soldiers were on hand. Maruf moved from the wheelhouse and helped moor the hovercraft alongside the docks, then grabbed an assault rifle.
Let me get the Americans.
Maruf went to the passenger cabin and climbed down the steps. Olin, Kissinger, and Otis sat on the bench seat much as they had back at the checkpoint. This time, however, both their blindfolds and binds were secured tightly. Grimaldi, Bon, Rojas, and Mokhtar were nowhere to be seen.
The plane hasn't taken off yet. I'll proceed as planned once I turn you over.
Stand!
Are you sure you can do this? Remember, we have backup plans.
The other plans are not as good. Let me do this.
Keeping his rifle trained on the men, Maruf helped guide them up the steps to the deck in single file. Bolin, Kissinger, then Otis.
We back some long shots in our day, Striker, but this one takes a kick.
Half a mile from Daimatan, Jack Grimaldi pulled off the road and drove the jeep to a stop behind a tall cluster of vine-infested brambles. Grimaldi looked over at Rocky Mokhtar, who was grimacing in pain.
Sorry about all the bumps.
Yeah, well, they hurt less than those crocodile's teeth would have.
Mokhtar's shoulder was bandaged, and his left arm was in a makeshift sling to cut down on the chances of reopening the wound. Jane Bond was in the back of the jeep. Like the men, she was still wearing a robe taken from one of the slain Lashkar terrorists. She and Grimaldi had also smeared their faces and hands with river mud. The ruse wasn't likely to fool anyone for more than a fleeting second, but given the odds they were up against, they were determined to seize any possible advantage. Tucking a loose strand of hair under the headpiece rounding out her disguise, she climbed out of the jeep. There was a faint smell of smoke in the breeze as they abandoned the jeep and crossed over the road to a ditch.
Let's get a move on.
Looks like we got a fire cloud drifting in.
Yeah, that could help us.
I don't know about that. I know it'd give us more cover, but I'd just as soon see where we're going.
Up the rise here.
They'd gone nearly 50 yards when the ground beneath their feet turned a shade darker, blackened by a recent fire. Recalling the directions Maruf had given them, they turned and started up the slope, soon coming upon a quarter-mile stretch of charred terrain. Maruf had explained that the land had been cleared more than 6 months ago to provide lumber for barracks and other facilities at the quarry. There was some new growth pushing up through the scorched earth, but for the most part, all Grimaldi and the others could see were tree stumps poking up from the ground at irregular intervals. There were hundreds of them. They made their way through the obstacle course. The terrain was hilly, rising in spots and then dipping into shallow valleys. Maruf had told them to keep an eye open for a pronounced indentation along the highest ridgeline, and once they spotted it, they veered course toward it and proceeded with even more caution, crouching low and using the exposed trunks for cover. Bond kept an eye on the landmark as she moved forward alongside Grimaldi. They paused behind another of the trucks and waited for Mokhtar to catch up with them.
I don't see any sentries. He said if there were any, they'd be up along the crest.
Let's play it safe.
How are you holding up?
I'll manage.
Are you sure? If you have to, you can switch over and come with me.
It's important that I go with her. You can handle your end alone.
Thanks for the vote of confidence, Rock, but the truth is, I could use at least a couple more guys. And you two could use a small army.
Well, unless Able Team and Phoenix Force beam down from the USS Enterprise, that's not going to happen. So let's just stick to the plan. I can gut it out. After all, it's just a flesh wound.
Good man.
By now, they were on their way up the final rise leading to the upper ridgeline.
Stay put and cover us.
Grimaldi and Bond crawled the last dozen yards on their stomachs. Mokhtar propped his M16 on the trunk before him, then watched the other two slowly inch their way up the slope. Once they reached the crest, Grimaldi turned and waved Mokhtar forward. When he reached the indentation, Mokhtar saw the gaping mouth to a tunnel large enough for a small truck to pass through. Maruf had told them that most of the lumber was transported to the quarry through the tunnel, as it was quicker than overland. There was still no sign of any sentries guarding the opening.
Our lucky day.
Still, you better watch yourselves once you head down.
How's your sense of direction? Better than mine, I hope.
I have a good sense, and I remember all the turns Maruf described.
Then you're definitely coming with me. One wrong turn down there, and who knows where the hell we'll end up.
Good luck.
You too. See you soon.
Grimaldi nodded, then watched as Bond and Mokhtar headed into the tunnel. Once they'd vanished into the shadows, he turned his attention from the cave and inched closer to the far side of the scallop in the ridgeline. When he reached the rim, he peered out into the night. 50 yards away was the knoll leading to the helicopters. Grimaldi could see more than a dozen men milling around both gunships. It didn't seem to matter which one he should try to gain access to. From the looks of it, it was going to take more than a robe and a smeared face for him to get close to either one. Still, he had to make a decision and go for it. He shifted his gaze back and forth, trying to calculate which was his best bet. He finally opted on a less scientific approach.
Eeny, meeny, miny, mo.
Surrounded by total darkness, AC Rojas shifted uncomfortably and wiped the sweat from his brow. His legs were starting to cramp up on him, and the air inside the enclosed space was getting stale, reeking of perspiration and the faintly cloying smell of motor fuel.
Good thing I'm not claustrophobic.
Rojas shifted his legs slightly in hopes of increasing the circulation. Another few minutes passed. Rojas raised his left hand close to his face and pressed a recessed button on his watch. The time flashed with a dull luminescent glow. 11:36. 24 minutes to go. Rojas doubted he could stay cooped up that long. He waited a few minutes longer, then reached up and gently pushed at the plywood above him. The board tilted, and Rojas slowly sat up. He was concealed in a storage space beneath the bench seat in the passenger cabin of the hovercraft. Through the open doorway, he could catch a glimpse of the docks. He listened intently. When he failed to hear any signs of activity, he swung the seat all the way up and then cautiously climbed out. He was wearing one of the hazmat suits taken from the back of the jeep at the checkpoint. He stretched his legs briefly. Rojas moved to the stairwell and peered out. He'd heard Maruf tell the dockhands that there were problems with the hovercraft's engine, and that they would need to have mechanics look at it in the morning before they considered using it for transport. The hands had apparently bought the story because the dock was deserted. Rojas deliberated whether he should leave the craft. If he could clear the docks without being seen, Maruf had explained there was a lower walkway that would allow him to reach the periphery of the quarry without being seen from the plateau. If he went for it now, however, he would still have to wait out the clock, and it seemed more likely someone would spot him near the quarry than if he stayed put. Better, he thought, to wait until the last minute. Rojas stepped back from the stairwell. He'd left the bench seat up so that, if need be, he could quickly return to cover. Pacing the cabin, he fidgeted with his pistol, making sure it was loaded and that the sound suppressor was securely in place. He patted his fanny pack, making sure the grenades were still there. Finally, he stole another glance at his watch. 11:42, 18 minutes to go. Olin stood impatiently on what he assumed was some sort of platform. He was still blindfolded, and his hands were still tied behind his back. The Lashkar hard men had cut the binds around his ankles after frisking him on the docks, and he'd led the procession as he, Kissinger, and Otis had been guided along a path leading to the plateau where troops continued to stockpile supplies. From the plateau, they had been marched across a short wooden bridge to the platform. The way the sounds carried, Olin guessed he was somewhere near the edge of the quarry pit. Kissinger and Otis were standing close by. Maruf wasn't among them. He'd excused himself after leading the would-be mercenaries ashore, saying he wanted to check on the plane. Several minutes passed. The delay was beginning to concern Bolin.
What's taking so long?
You wait!
I'm tired of waiting. We want to do what we came here for.
You wait!
Bolin was answered by a blow to the ribs with the butt of an assault rifle. He staggered slightly, brushing up against what felt like a wall of chicken wire. Olin fell silent, anger and frustration building inside him as he stood there with bruised ribs. Moments later, the platform shook slightly and then began to descend into the quarry.
An elevator.
A second later, Olin felt the barrel of a gun press against his cheek. Olin felt a tugging on his sleeve. He followed Kissinger and Otis out of the elevator. They were led single file along a dirt path. Olin assumed they were at the base of the quarry pit. Maruf told them the execution would take place there, but soon he found himself being led into a tunnel. Not good, Olin thought. This would throw the entire plan off. He couldn't say anything without drawing suspicion. They hadn't gone far along the shaft when Olin and the others were steered through a narrow opening.
Stand still!
The guards removed the blindfolds. Olin blinked and looked around him. They were in a small chamber the size of a prison cell carved out of the bedrock. The only light came from the flickering of an oil lamp ensconced on the wall. The only furnishings were a pair of army cots, upon which were piled a half dozen rumpled uniforms of the U.S. Marines. One of the guards untied Bolin's hands.
You change clothes now!
Bolin rubbed his chafed wrists and stole a glance at his watch. A sinking feeling roiled in his stomach. 11:48. They had only 12 minutes. Once all three men were untied, the guards stood back, blocking the entrance to the tunnel, holding their assault rifles at the ready.
Change clothes and no talking!
Olin fished through the uniforms for one that looked as if it might fit him, then turned his back on the guards and began to strip. As he did so, he exchanged looks with Otis and Kissinger. They too seemed aware of the time and had a look of grim resignation on their faces. The men dressed wearily. Olin's uniform was a close fit, as was Kissinger's. Otis had trouble getting into his shirt and switched it for another. They were tying their boots when there was a disruption at the doorway.
Make way!
Olin glanced up and found himself staring into the face of Moammar Poto. Poto was in his mid-30s but looked much older, with gray streaks in his beard and shoulder-length hair. His dark eyes stood out in his face, gleaming with far more vitality than his haggard features. He stood just less than 6 feet tall and was wearing a simple white robe not unlike those of the guards on either side of him.
So, here are our CIA co-conspirators.
You're mistaken. We work on our own.
That is not the information I was given.
Your information was wrong. Yes, the CIA tried to recruit us, but we didn't make any deals with them.
Why should I believe you?
Does it really matter? All you're concerned about is having us kill Yafal for you. Whose side we're on doesn't make any difference. Either way, you'll be dead, and you'll have what you want.
True enough. But aren't you concerned about your payment?
There won't be any payment. We all know that. Once we've done our job, there's nothing to stop you from killing us, too.
But that was not the agreement. We discussed money.
And we played along. Face it, you can't send out a videotape of us killing Yafal and have anybody buy it if we're alive to say it was a setup.
Now I'm confused. If you felt this assignment would cost you your lives, why go through with it?
I lost family on that cruise liner Yafal bombed. I want the satisfaction of having my revenge.
At any cost?
At any cost. Do you think you're the only people who believe in suicide missions if the cause is worth it?
I am impressed. A little skeptical, perhaps, but impressed nonetheless.
Bolin stole another glance at his watch. 11:52.
Let's get it over with. Where is he?
Yafal is being readied. You'll have your chance soon enough.
Now or never.
You're dictating terms.
You heard me. Get your cameras and let's get rolling.
Or else?
Or else you've got no show. Unless you want to dress some of your men up to do the job in our place.
That would hardly be credible.
You've got 30 seconds and then the uniform comes off.
We can force you to cooperate.
That would hardly be credible. 25 seconds. 20 seconds.
Fine, fine. You want to feel in control. I can appreciate that. Very well. We will, as you say in Hollywood, let the show begin.
The Hercules C-130's engines were already warming up when Waheed Maruf approached the firefighting plane. That would help. But when he glanced up at the nearby knoll, Maruf saw a handful of soldiers still standing around the two Sultan helicopters. Clearly, Grimaldi had not yet been able to make his move to board one of the choppers. Maruf glanced at his watch. 11:50. He had to do something. The plane spray tanks had already been filled with chemicals, and one of the flatbed trucks had been emptied, but the second truck was still half filled with containers. Instead of the impregnable casks the herbicides had been stored in when they'd left the agri-compound in Samarinda, the fluids had been transferred to 5-gallon clear plastic drums, the same type used for holding drinking water. The plastic containers would easily burst open when the plane crashed into the parliament, ensuring a broader decimation of toxins. By the same token, their fragility required careful handling as they were transferred from the truck to the cargo hold of the Hercules. At the rate they were moving, Maru figured it would take at least another 5 minutes to finish loading. That would be cutting things too close. He moved away from the plane.
You men, standing next to the choppers, make yourselves useful. Come down and help with the loading, immediately. We need to take off before the smoke obscures the runway.
After a moment's hesitation, the soldiers began to jog down to the plane. Two of them, however, remained atop the hill. Maruf was about to call out to them, but checked himself. He was worried about raising suspicions. Grimaldi would have to manage to get past the last two men on his own.
Come, we must all pitch in.
Maruf himself joined in and helped load the last of the chemicals. Inside the cargo hold, two men with clipboards carefully orchestrated the placement of the containers. Maruf recognized them as the same scientists who'd helped develop the bomb that had gone off at the consulate in Samarinda. As with that bomb, they were seeing to it that the chemicals were stacked in such a way as to maximize their deadly effect when the plane exploded into Parliament. The containers were finally all loaded aboard the cargo plane. One of the scientists looked over the stored chemicals, more than 90 containers in all, each strapped securely in place on a bed of foam padding.
Are we ready?
Yes, everything is ready.
Then pray to Allah for success with the mission.
You're not staying on board, are you?
Of course, to co-pilot.
But the plan was to use just one pilot. You are too valuable.
We must be prepared for all contingencies. And what could be more valuable than to see this mission through?
You've cleared this with Poto?
It was his suggestion, and it will be my honor. Now go.
The two scientists headed down the ramp, shaking their heads as they left. Maruf helped close the cargo ramp, then strode carefully past the stacked containers, making his way to the front of the plane. Inside the cockpit, the pilot, a middle-aged Lashkar terrorist, whirled in his seat when Maruf came through the door.
Maruf, what are you doing here?
I could not let you have all the glory, Elgir. I am to co-pilot. It was Porto's recommendation, and I accept it.
I am capable of flying this mission alone, but if it is Porto's wish, so be it.
Have you gone through the checklist?
We are ready for takeoff.
That is what I hoped.
Maruf slowly withdrew a knife from his robe. Before Elgir could react, he leaned across the console and plunged the 6-inch blade into the pilot's chest.
Ah! Maruf!
He twisted the blade sharply, then left it in place and watched the life drain from Elgir's eyes.
Forgive me, Elgir.
He quickly dragged the man from his seat and took his place at the controls. Maruf stared at his watch. 11:55.
I put my trust in Allah.
Grimaldi made his move the moment some of the men began to walk downhill away from the helicopters. Using the charred tree trunks for cover, he slowly made his way toward the knoll, cutting the distance by half before coming to a sudden halt, realizing he'd run out of trunks to hide behind. That there were still two armed men posted near the Sultan's gave him pause as well. He remained crouched behind the last trunk, hoping they'd move and join the others. The men stayed put, however, lighting up cigarettes. He glanced at his watch, 11:55. He couldn't afford to wait much longer. From where he was hiding, the knoll blocked Grimaldi's view of the Hercules C-130. He was wondering how Maruf had fared with his end of the mission when he suddenly realized the plane's engines were getting louder. Seconds later, the Hercules came into view, gaining speed as it rolled down the access road. Grimaldi glanced back at the men on the hill. They too were watching the plane, backs turned to him. Grimaldi saw his opportunity and went for it. Even as he was moving clear of the trunk and breaking into a run, Grimaldi was tearing off his robe, wary that it would flap too loudly and tip off his approach. Underneath, he was wearing one of the hazmat suits taken from the Jeep. As he reached the base of the hill and started up, he drew his gun, finger close to the trigger. He was within 20 yards of the men when one of them spotted him. Without hesitation, Grimaldi fired a silenced round into the man's head. He quickly shifted aim and took out the second man with another two shots. When he reached the top of the knoll, Grimaldi dropped onto his stomach, wriggling past the bodies and glancing down the other side. The other Lashkar terrorists were still down by the flatbed trucks, watching the Hercules take off. Grimaldi glanced to his left and saw the plane rising up into the smoky haze. Grimaldi crawled over to the nearest Sultan and climbed into the cockpit. He quickly checked over the controls, assuring him the chopper was ready for takeoff at a moment's notice. When his eyes fell on the console clock, he felt a stab of panic. The clock read midnight. He quickly checked his watch and let out a breath. The console clock was off. 11:58. Mokhtar and Bon were standing at a junction where the tunnel split off in four separate directions.
Which way?
All the way to the left.
Bon was about to move on when she saw Mokhtar close his eyes and clench his teeth. She noticed the growing patch of crimson soaking through his robe.
You're bleeding again?
Let's just keep going.
Are you?
Go! Let's go!
So far, their journey through the quarry tunnels had been devoid of complications. They'd taken a wrong turn early on, but had quickly corrected themselves. And though they'd passed two different chambers teeming with Lashkar soldiers, one a barracks, where nearly five dozen men had been sleeping, the other a storage area where troops were preoccupied with loading supplies for the transfer to Ertonon, they had yet to contend with a face-to-face confrontation. That changed as they rounded the next bend. Up ahead, two men brandishing Uzis were striding directly toward them. Bon was ready for them. The other man was drawing his Uzi into play when Mokhtar beat him to the draw. Bon and Mokhtar nonetheless froze in place momentarily, eyeing the tunnel in both directions on the chance someone might have heard the shooting.
What now?
Let's leave them and keep going. We should almost be there.
Wait! Just in case.
Mokhtar grabbed the dead man's Uzis and handed Bon one of the weapons. After another 40 yards, they came to a chiseled corridor lined with passageways leading into separate small chambers. The one Maruf had told them about was the last one on the left, less than 10 yards from the opening that led out to the quarry pit itself. There was an 8-inch thick steel pocket door built into the chamber entrance, but as Maruf had predicted, it had been left open. Mokhtar went in first, Bon followed. They found themselves in a fortified bomb shelter, complete with provisions, communications equipment, and a stockpile of weapons. Stacked in a neat pile just inside the door were a dozen full-body hazmat suits. Mokhtar stared covetously at the communications setup.
If only we had a little more time.
Well, scratch that!
Maruf had told them where to locate the panel switch operating the door. Bon quickly tried it. She pushed the button again, and the door reopened.
Okay, all set. Ready?
We better be.
Mokhtar checked his watch. 11:59. Maruf had been right. Hamed Yafal's execution was to take place in the quarry pit after all. There was a trio of mercury vapor lamps. Only one was situated at the bottom of the pit, while the other two rested on posts up at the periphery, one near the elevator and another on the far side of the quarry. Though the lamps were high-powered, they had a lot of area to cover. The pit alone was almost half the size of a baseball stadium, and the illumination they provided was diffused to a pale, otherworldly shade of yellow. An open area was stripped bare of all adornment, save for a few large boulders and the bodies of three UIF bodyguards, whose lives had been spared back at the mountain enclave, so that they could now serve as background props for their leader's final appearance as ruling head of the United Islamic Front. The men had been brought out to the pit only a few moments before, then summarily gunned down by some of the two dozen armed Lashkar Jihad soldiers on hand to ensure that Poto was adequately protected as he watched his hand-picked crew of American mercenaries kill and then decapitate his longtime rival. As for the rest of Poto's men, a dozen or more were still up near the plateau, while the rest were in the surrounding caves, either asleep or gathering more supplies for the next day's relocation march to Antonon. Poto had ordered the use of 3 handheld video cameras. Each one would tape Yafal's killing from a slightly different angle, so that Poto could later choose which footage best depicted the savagery of the beheading. Now, as midnight fast approached, the moment of truth was at hand. Crouched beside the largest of the boulders, Bolin, Kissinger, and Otis, all dressed in their second-hand Marine uniforms, clutched M16s filled with blanks and stared out at the slain UIF bodyguards strewed on the ground 20 yards ahead of them, supposedly just felled by their carbines. The cameramen stood a few yards behind them, and another 20 yards back stood Poto, perched on a 4-foot-high platform, holding a sniper rifle with a high-powered scope. His own bodyguard stood in formation around the platform. He seemed satisfied that everything was ready.
Bring us the great Nile Viper!
As Bolin and the others silently watched, 3 figures began to slowly materialize out of the darkness of the cave directly across from them. 2 were Poto's men. Between them, half limping, half staggering, was Ahmed Yafal. Poto had secured a makeup specialist, and Yafal was outfitted with a wig and beard that accurately recreated the visage that had been plastered across newspapers and the nightly news for the past 5 months. The snake-like birthmark on his forehead was clearly visible in the pale overhead light, as was the dulled-over vacant gaze in his eyes. Once they reached the slain bodyguards, the 2 soldiers moved off to either side, leaving Yafal to stand alone among the corpses, dazed and trembling, barely able to stand on his own 2 feet.
They got him drugged. That hardly seems fair.
I'm all choked up.
Bolin didn't respond. Crouched between the other 2 men, he drew his M16 tighter to his body and reached out with his right hand, slowly loosening the bayonet with which he was supposed to behead Yafal. As he did so, he glanced over his shoulder. Moammar Poto had raised his rifle and was taking aim at his rival's chest. Had he been looking at his watch, Bolin would have seen that it had just struck midnight. When they had been laying out their plan back at the checkpoint on the river, Rojas had told Bolin and the others that years ago, while playing center field for a minor league baseball team in Palm Springs, a scout told him he had one of the best throwing arms he'd ever seen. Now was his chance to prove it. 2 minutes earlier, he had successfully made his way from the moored hovercraft to the edge of the quarry, giving him a clear view of the preparations for Ahmed Yafal's execution. As he watched Moammar Poto raise his rifle and take aim, Rojas pulled the pins on the 2 smoke grenades he'd just removed from his fanny pack. In quick succession, he threw the 2 projectiles into the pit. 100 yards behind him, the timed plastic charges inside the hovercraft detonated. The craft turned into a fireball, showering debris along the docks and across the river. Moammar Poto released his finger from the trigger of his rifle and glanced over his shoulder. The guards surrounding him did the same. They saw a burst of light where the hovercraft had gone up in flames and watched as several of the men on the plateau were knocked off balance by the force of the explosion, tumbled down the slope, and fell over the edge of the quarry, plummeting to their deaths. Clouds of smoke began to rise where the grenades had landed. Before the guards could respond, a hail of Uzi SMG rounds from one of the cave entrances slammed into them. As Kissinger and Otis dived to their right, then scrambled back to their feet and rushed toward the cave, Bolin whirled, holding the bayonet by its gleaming blade. Poto was barely visible above the rising bank of smoke. Bolin took quick aim and let the bayonet fly. End over end, the blade hurtled through the smoke, finally sheathing itself in Poto's chest. Dumbfounded, the leader of the Lashkar Jihad stared down at the hilt, then slowly dropped his rifle and pitched forward over the railing to the ground. He was dead before he landed. Bolin broke into a run, quickly catching up with Kissinger and Otis. As they neared the cave, they saw Bon and Mokhtar standing in the opening, firing their Uzis through the smoke screen at Poto's remaining bodyguards. Several of the guards had regained their wits and managed to find cover behind some of the nearest boulders. As the smoke drifted past them, they spotted Bolin and the others and raised their rifles, hoping to nail the men before they escaped into the cave. Before they could take aim, however, they suddenly became aware of a loud droning sound overhead. Glancing upward, their eyes widened with horror. Streaking toward them out of the heavens at a speed of more than 400 miles an hour was the Hercules C-130 firefighting plane with its lethal cargo of pesticides.
Hurry!
The others were close behind. One by one, they followed her into the bunker. Bolin was the last one in. Bon had her hand on the wall switch, and the moment the executioner passed through the opening, she triggered the door. The ground trembled, knocking everyone off his or her feet. Bolin rolled to one side as a storage locker came crashing down to the floor. Bolin slowly rose to his feet and looked at the others.
Everyone all right?
They all nodded. The stack of hazmat suits had collapsed in the explosion. Silently, Bolin and the others reached into the pile and began to pull the suits on over their clothes. Once he'd finished, Bolin tipped the storage locker onto its side, opened its door, and started handing out gas masks.
If I never have to wear one of these clown suits again, it'll be too soon.
Outside of the bomb shelter, the force of the explosion had propelled clouds of toxic vapor deep into the caves. And as they made their way through the haze-filled tunnels, Bolin and the others had to move carefully to avoid tripping over the bodies of Lashkar troops who'd been overcome while trying to flee. Passing one of the caves being used as a barracks, they saw dozens of men sprawled dead on the floor and on the rows of cots. The chamber where supplies had been stored was filled with corpses as well. After a few hundred yards of twists and turns, signs of the vapor began to fade. Finally, 11 minutes after they'd left the shelter, Bon and Mokhtar led the group out through the same opening where they'd entered the tunnel complex. Grimaldi was waiting for them in the Sultan. He'd already picked up Rojas, and the mercenary helped the others aboard.
That baseball scout was right. You were right on the money.
Too bad I couldn't hit a curveball.
Bolin stared out the copter door and saw a bright glow shining through the thick clouds still rising up from the quarry. Mokhtar was the last one in. His robe was drenched with blood, and he was close to passing out.
Where's Maruf?
He never ejected. I guess he wanted to make sure the plane hit dead center.
Major Abdul Salim hung up the phone and turned to Bolin. They were in Salim's room at the hospital. The major was still hooked up to IVs, but his condition was improving. He'd eaten his first solid food since being brought to the facility, and the color had come back to his face. The doctors had yet to set a timetable for his rehabilitation and release, but he was anxious to get back into uniform and resume his duties. Outside, the morning sky was leaden, still filled with smoke from the fires raging in the mountains. At least for now, however, the smoke seemed less foreboding.
That was General Saseno. We've pinpointed a small force of Lashkar troops on the move in the mountains near Ertonen. We'll be sending in Kopassus units to engage them once we've softened them up with airstrikes.
I hope it goes well.
We have them where we want them, on the run and without a leader. Hopefully we can wipe them out before they have a chance to regroup.
Even if they do, they won't be the threat they were just a few days ago.
We have you to thank for that.
It wasn't just me.
Of course. But without your help, I shudder to think how different the situation would be. I still can't believe Sergeant Latek was our turncoat.
At least he was the only one.
My taxi's here. Help me with my bags.
Major Salim, Jane Bon. Jane, Major Salim. I'm sure your respective reputations precede you both. Excuse me, Major. A fair damsel in distress.
Go ahead. We'll talk later. Nice to have met you, Miss Bond.
Out in the hall, a work crew was repairing the damage from the earlier shootout. They'd already cleaned the blood off the floors and were nearly done replacing the sections of the walls that had been hammered with gunfire.
I just saw your friend Rocky. He says now that he's got some of your blood in his veins, he might have to stick with commando work.
Bolin grinned. Over the objections of the hospital staff, he'd donated 2 units of blood to help Mokhtar out as he went into surgery for the gunshot wound to his shoulder. The procedure had been successful, and Mokhtar was expected to join Bolin, Kissinger, and Grimaldi when they left Indonesia at the end of the week.
So, what's next for you?
Cayman Islands, chasing down some embezzlers. Sounds pretty boring, eh?
I hear the weather's nice.
I've been there a couple times before. I know this nice romantic bungalow overlooking the ocean. Be a great place to recharge your batteries. Interested?
Don't think I'm not tempted.
Still playing hard to get, are we?
Maybe when the time is right.
They approached a taxi. The cab driver already had his trunk open. As Boland set down her luggage, the cab driver loaded her bags into the trunk. Bond leaned over and kissed his head.
That bump's nearly gone.
I'm as hard-headed as they come.
Tell me about it. When the time's right, you know where to find...
Bond pulled a business card from her purse and slipped it into the pocket of Boland's shirt. With a wink, she got into the cab. Boland waited at the curb, then waved as Bond rode off into the busy traffic. He was about to return to the hospital when he suddenly changed his mind and headed north along the sidewalk. A few minutes later, he was standing outside the American consulate. The building was still cordoned off, and hazmat crews were inside trying to rid the ducts of any last traces of the lethal chemicals unleashed by the Lashkar's bomb attack. A makeshift memorial had been set up near one of the barriers surrounding the consulate perimeter. An enterprising vendor had set up a cart nearby, selling flowers and candles. Boland bought two candles and took them over to the memorial. He set one candle before a large framed photograph of Ambassador Stansfield, the other next to a smaller, wallet-sized photo of the Marine he'd spoken to the day he'd come out of the computer room where the bomb had been placed. Once he lit the candles, he stood back, taking in the memorial. Then he glanced up at the U.S. flag flying at half-mast in front of the consulate. Standing tall, Boland saluted.
Mac Bolan, Pressure Point, is a graphic audio production. Mac Bolan is a trademark owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2004, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2006, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Jeff Baker, Terrence Aselford, Richard Rowan, David Coyne, Nanette Savard, James Konacek, Christopher Graybill, Ken Jackson, Thomas Penny, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Bob Supan. Dialogue editing by Johann Detweiler. Graphic audio sound design by Johann Detweiler and Chris Rowan. The Mac Bolan theme was composed by Chris Rowan. Book adapted for graphic audio by Tanya Perez. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed Mac Bolan, be sure to look for Don Pendleton's Stony Man and the Executioner, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening for previews of other graphic audio thrillers.
The following previews are of graphic audio productions rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Mac Bolan works night and day to protect the United States of America. But he isn't the only one. The government has had long-standing agents in the field with vital agendas.
Okay, Stryker. What do you know about Project Zodiac?
I've heard rumors. Some sort of doomsday plan from the Cold War.
That's damn close. 12 deep cover agents scattered across Europe, each equipped with a compact nuclear device that fits into a standard-sized briefcase. Each of these has a full 1/4 kiloton yield. Very nasty stuff. Dirty as hell.
But when the unexpected happens...
The bastards got them. Zalharis and his crew stole the entire shipment of Zodiacs.
A band of Brazilian mercenaries known as the Scion hold the trigger on 4 weapons of mass destruction. And they're bringing them
on American soil.
These are kamikaze models. Damage the casing, and even if it's not already armed, the bomb will detonate automatically. The Zodiacs have to be recovered intact and undamaged.
The threat is real, and the bloodthirsty mercenaries are already here. Bolin will have to scour the states to track down the heartless killers. And even at the top of his game, he can't be everywhere at once.
Did they just toss something overboard? Why on earth is that?
In the Scion's unholy sale, death goes to the highest bidder. Don't miss 1 minute of Mac Bolin 96. Stolen Arrows.
I used to be a symbol of peace. Now they run away in fear. I've failed my mission.
The pieces are in place.
Protocol, tower watch, receive.
The game is set.
This is what the Titans meant. They're going to die.
Why would Superman risk everything?
Lois was the only one of us who still believed in you.
To save someone he loves.
But you took her!
It will be undone!
Alliances have formed.
Your Earth has been splintered into a multiverse. The Earths will become weaker, and if they aren't brought back together soon, everything will be destroyed.
Now, the endgame can begin.
We've all made mistakes, Superman. But it's not too late to learn from them.
DC Comics.
Infinite Crisis, Part 2.
It can't end this way!
Available now.
www.graphicaudio.net. By Greg Cox. Based on the DC Comics miniseries.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.